you may do as much research as you want, but there are surprises along the way because there are some things that you may not know that you may know, but then you don't know what the next step to that is. Only when you arrive here do you learn those things. And it's very important when you relocate to also learn about the immigration system. I think that's very important, regardless of what status you are, whether you come here as a visitor, whether you come here as a student or as a fiance or whatever it may be. Learn the immigration system, learn the rights that you have, what you can and cannot do within your, you know, within that framework that you're given. I think it's very important.
This is Assorted Immigrant Stories podcast. My name is Zenith Mwangahamambamalao, and I am your host. And for those of you that are stopping by for the very first time, this is a podcast about immigrant journeys, the things I and others wish we knew. We have interviews and share conversations with immigrants from diverse backgrounds and countries as they share their own immigration stories. We explore struggles, triumphs, and cultural adjustments. We discuss identity, belonging, and community, and we also highlight successes and contributions to both American society and back home, and that's wherever home might be. We also review some books that touch on the immigrant story. So don't forget to rate and review, like, share, and subscribe to wherever you get your podcast from. Welcome to the season finale of Assorted Immigrant Stories. Today's episode is both a book-centered conversation and a personal immigration story. But before we begin, please note, listener discretion advised as we touch on sensitive topics, including pregnancy loss, miscarriage, IVF, and IUI. I'm honored to be joined by Angela Nedeljkovic, a seasoned healthcare professional with over 20 years of experience in revenue cycle, healthcare information management, auditing, and compliance. Angela is also the co-founder of Titandizike Children and Women's Organization, which supports vulnerable women and children in Zambia's Luangwa district in Lusaka. She recently authored Echoes of Unspoken Loss. It was actually my book recommendation of last month, so please check it out. A powerful book that sheds light on grief, healing, and the silent struggles many women face. In this conversation, Angela shares what inspired her to write the book, and also takes us through her own coming to America story. Angela, welcome to the show and say hello to our listeners and tell us where you're recording from.
Hello, my name is Angela and I'm recording from Maryland, USA.
Okay, thank you for being here. Okay, so we're going to jump right into it. So tell us, we just mentioned that you're the author of Echoes of Unspoken Loss, and being an immigrant here, you've been here for so many years. What inspired you to finally break the silence and write Echoes of Unspoken Loss?
It started off as a journal. It wasn't like one particular event that just had me document or write down the book. It started off as a journal, just a way to express myself while I was going through the process. So with my first miscarriage, I remember writing a letter to my child. And so that was the first thing that I put down. And at the time, I didn't really trust anyone with my emotions. Actually, through the journey itself, I felt like expressing myself was almost like exposing myself in a sense. Mm-hmm. So I had to protect myself and then also protect my family. I know my husband was grieving. My mother was grieving. So it was an outlet. So, you know, journaling became like an escape, so to say.
Okay. And let me tell you, the letters to my children, so beautiful, so powerful. I think it's my favorite part of the book. So you all go buy that book. It's at the end of the book and read it. Very inspiring. And Angela, you just said something. You wrote journals because I think that was a way of expressing yourself. And I know, for example, our culture growing up, and even though things are changing, as women, we experience these things, whether it's a miscarriage or just infertility or anything in that realm. We experience these things, but don't know how to share them because either we think it's considered a taboo or you will not be considered as a whore, or even just the way you feel yourself. So with the Zambian background, how did that influence the way you experienced going through having a miscarriage itself?
So I think because I came here fairly young, I don't know how much that, experience shaped my whole grieving process or, influenced me in any way. I come from a very praying family. I think regardless of one's background, a lot of women struggle in silence, right? So this is not just a societal issue, but it's a global issue. And here in the West, I think it's much easier to express yourself. There's a sense of like empathy, like through your grieving process. As I recall, like back home, it's like, somebody dies or somebody goes through a loss. You grieve for like that 1 month, right? You bury, you grieve for that 1 month in the Tonga culture, which I'm Tonga. There is a post burial process where you have that ceremony, called Muecho, where you celebrate and then you allow like the spirits to, go to the next realm, or you celebrate that one person's life. I'm not quite sure, but I remember having, those ceremonies, through, a loss of a family member or something like that. So you're expected to move on within a short period of time. I think that, here in the States, people allow you the space to grieve, I guess, for as long as you can, right? Because grieving, it's not like a straightforward thing where you grieve a certain way. Like everyone grieves very differently. Sometimes you think you're fine and then it hits you. But I think there's a sense of empathy in allowing a person to grieve and not moving on as quickly. So in that regard, perhaps there was a difference in how, one moves on in life. It took me a very, very long time to get over, grieving. And again, with my miscarriages, it was almost like year after year. So that was very, very tough. But in the end, I think having a very close circle of friends, trusted individuals, really did help. So it was a mix of, the Zambian process of grieving, I think, that I remember, that I experienced, and then this new way of having to deal with things. Because even as during my grieving process, I still had to go to work. I still had to do the things that I needed to do to make sure that, financially we're okay. And it's not like I'm the only financial, the breadwinner of the family. My husband also, does work. But to maintain a certain lifestyle or to still, work on the projects that you wanted to work on, I still had to show up. So my life became compartmentalized, so to speak. And I did that very intentionally and very carefully. Like, work was work, home was home. When I came home, there was a realization that, oh, I'm going through this. Because now I see, my husband looks at me and he's worried about me. And then now I start to worry about him. And then I realize, oh, well, we're going through this. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad that I had very supportive friends, and my family's very supportive.
I was going to ask about that support, because often what I've realized is that we come here, usually we're young and we're not mm-hmm. thinking about the future so much, right? And we mm-hmm. leave families behind. So for a lot of us immigrants, maybe you're the only one. Sometimes you have a sibling, you have a cousin, maybe across states, everywhere. Mm-hmm. So you experience something and you realize, oh my God, there's no one. And you have to rely on your friends or right. the community that you build. And I was going to ask what that looked like for you, the community around here. How was that support like? And how was even the support from home? How did you navigate that?
I think that everyone allowed me my space So the way that I grieved, I think I in the beginning, I didn't want to face what was going on. And I didn't expose myself too much to like close friends and family, because family and, you know, people that love you tend to feel your pain. And sometimes, even if you are not in that headspace of, oh, okay, I'm actually going through this, they do remind you, like, oh, you know, how are you feeling today? Or there's that sense of care that, you know, reminds you that you actually do have a problem. But they gave me space to heal. My friends kind of know my personality. So sometimes, you know, if I don't want to talk or I don't pick up the phone, I'll get a text. I would get like a prayer or something. So yeah, just having that level of support that understood my grieving process in a sense was very helpful.
You know, last week, Saturday, May 24th, you had a beautiful book launch that I attended. It was a beautiful brunch. Mm-hmm. And there was a young lady there, and she shared her story of having breast cancer at 19 and not having a community to share it with, because most people, she said, when she went there, most people were already in their 40s, 50s, they've had children, and she's 19, never froze her eggs, and is unclear what that will look like for her when it's time for her to have children. But also, more importantly, not finding groups of people in her age who've experienced this, because like she said, while everybody was going to college or having children, she was having chemotherapy. And what I thought was, oh, wow, she could be the one to start that support group. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just wanted to find if perhaps, Angela, you could be the person to, you and even the young lady, to, do you plan to start some sort of support group for other women who are experiencing, who've experienced infertility, miscarriages, or other forms of not being able to have children?
I really did, you know, have a lot of empathy towards the young lady. And I wish that, you know, somehow I had known her when she was going through her process. But of course, you know, separate experiences, probably different timelines. In regard to starting something, I it's in the works. I don't know how it's going to turn out. So, you know, I'll just let it play out for now. You know, there's the book. And, you know, with the book, like I mentioned earlier, there are components to, you know, getting it out there that I didn't really think I would have to, you know, put forward. But it's, these are things that I have to work on. Eventually, yes, I don't mind. It is in the works. I have thought about it. It's not something that is an immediate plan, but definitely it is on my vision board, because I know that a lot of people struggle, and they struggle in silence. Yeah.
Much needed. So we're looking forward to that, and we will hold you accountable.
Please hold me accountable.
All right. So, you know, as I was reading the book and I was trying to get myself together, I asked my friends, it was supposed to be like a fitness group, those of us who finished in 1999 at Fatima Group. So we have a little WhatsApp group. And, you know, because in our culture growing up, and in most African cultures, I know things are changing. You know, a woman's identity is often tied to being Mrs. or mother of. Mm-hmm. And it dawned on me. So I started asking them, I was like, do you guys care that I just call you your first name? You know, that I don't call you Mrs. so-and-so or mother of. So when I thought about that, I was thinking, did that affect how you shared your information to, let's say, Zambians or Africans versus how you shared to people here in America? Because I know, like you said, people here are very open. You can just literally go and say, I'm experiencing this. I mean, it happened to me as well, where like I'm experiencing something, I just go to work and I just break down because I could. Mm-hmm. But I also knew that you can't just go to an African person like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did that affect how you shared that information with fellow Africans, you know, versus Americans?
It did not. With, you know, friends here and friends back home, it was a phase out process, if you want to call it, or is it phase in, one of those, where, you know, you tell a certain group first, or you tell a few people first, and then you tell the next people, you know, the next set of friends, second, and so on. And this was the same with, you know, relatives and, you know, work colleagues. Very few people at work actually knew what I was going through. I think just one or two people. So it wasn't something that, you know, greatly affected me in a sense where I feel like, you know, my Africanness has an influence on how I'm sharing this information. It was more so based on who would receive it and what kind of response would I get from them, you know? And then, again, the strategy behind it was more so a sense of protecting myself and also protecting those people that I know love me dearly. So I think that was the strategy. Fortunately, naturally, people want to help. And so you get, you know, advice where people tell you, oh, well, I know such and such used certain supplements or herbs and they were successful. And it's not out of malice. It's really out of a place of worry and a place of love. So again, I knew, knowing the people that I have in my life, because it's very intentional, like people that I bring into my life, right? So I knew, okay, this is the person that would want to give me a solution, and I'm not looking for that right now. What I'm looking for is just somebody to just be there, just to listen. Because there was a time when I really didn't want, I didn't want to hear anybody's suggestions or you know, I just wanted presence. Just for them to give me that platform. If I want to share what I'm going through, then let's talk about what I'm going through without you coming up with suggestions. And if I don't want to share what I'm going through and I just want to talk about something, maybe like, you know, something in the news or so I watch, allow me that space without bringing up something that is a reality right now. Yeah,
that's very powerful. And you know what, Angela, so just before I get to the point you just talked about, you know, in the end, when I was asking questions in the group with my friends, everybody agreed. They were like, you know what, I know that I am enough on my own before I ever became mother of or missus. So it's very important to point that out, that, you know, at the end of the day, the message we want to share is that you are enough. You are enough before you are Dr. So-and-so, this so-and-so, and mother of so-and-so, and that you can still contribute to society. People are busy mothering every day in so many different ways, in a million ways. We are mothering the world. Okay, and going back to...
Right. I was going to say, and I think that our generation is doing a lot better in self-identity, so to speak. I think our parents' generation was really more so concerned about, you know, you need to have children in order for you to be recognized as a woman, or you need to be married in order for you to be recognized in society or respected. But I think nowadays things are changing. And like you said, we are learning or have learned that at the end of the day, you need to know yourself. You are enough, you know. Everyone in life has different paths. We've all been assigned different things by God. And perhaps, you know, not being a missus it's not something that God wants you to do, right? Or where God wants you to be. But how can you contribute to the greater good just as you are? Or perhaps motherhood is not for you. How can you be a mother to people that need mothers? Because there are a lot of people, there are a lot of children out there that need mothers. There are a lot of people that need support. So how can you, as a human being, not as a missus and not as mother of such and such, how can you contribute to the greater plan that God has for you? I think that's the biggest thing that a lot of our generation are starting to understand.
Absolutely, absolutely agree. And to the point about people being suggestioned, like you just said, like we are learning and sometimes people mean well. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you might question if people mean well.
Exactly.
Ask you something and you'd be like, did they just ask that after I explained this?
Yeah.
So I want to know, what type of phrases should people stay away from that are like, that's just a no-no?
You know, I know that people come from a place of love. I could have, you know, some, maybe a phrase that I don't want somebody to say. Right. I know I have a friend who I know loves me very dearly. When she found out I had my third miscarriage, she was like, did you freeze your egg? Or, you know, do you have embryos or something like that? Well, I'm not thinking about what's happening next. I'm actually trying to go through the process right now. And then, you know, like I say, people offered suggestions and supplements. There were some, you know, people from back home who were like, oh, if you, you know, take this herb, it's good for you. I think that the one thing that, again, not coming, you know, out of malice, but out of love is, oh, well, you have gone through this miscarriage. Now your womb is open and you're going to have another child. Well, what if that's not the case for me? You know what I mean? So, yeah. So it depends on how you choose to receive, I think, also, because knowing that some people are actually coming out of a, you know, from a place of love, there are malicious people out there, but fortunately enough, I didn't have any of those. I think I didn't have any of those. I would like to believe I didn't. I will tell you, when I went to Zambia to visit maybe 2 years ago, I met with a group of friends from high school, and they all had families, they all had kids, and they knew, well, one of them knew that I had gone through, you know, challenges, and I'm sure she mentioned something to the group, and not one of them asked me, so do you have kids? Not one of them asked me. And I thought that that was very, I felt, for lack of a better term, even my English is not adding up right now. It was a good feeling in the sense that these people didn't really, you know, have that pressure to prove to me that, oh, they're mothers in a sense, and I'm not. So they gave me that grace to just be myself. Even though I did ask about their families, they showed me pictures, none of them really asked, like, you know, so why, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't until last year when I opened up, because I knew I was going to publish the book anyway, and I opened up to them, and I was in a place of peace. So I was able to talk about that with one of them that hadn't attended the first lunch that we had in 2023. Yeah. So again, you know, it depends on the circle of friends that you have.
Right. I agree. I was also very impressed. When I started to think about my own group, I was like, oh, okay. You know, actually nobody bothers about this. And, you know, you have different people from the group who, like, I know we have a friend in there who's decided, I just want to be an auntie. I don't want to have kids. But nobody's giving her a headache about that. Nobody's saying, oh my God, you must, you know?
Right.
Recently, I just saw one of our Zambian celebs on Facebook. She put it was one of her, she put a status, and I think she was saying, you know, she doesn't want to have children. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Half of the people came for her, but there was another half saying, hey, your choice, and we support you. And I was like, okay, we're going somewhere here.
Right.
Yeah, but obviously there are people who are like, you can't do that, you know, don't defy what God, you know, and all this stuff. So, you know, you always get that. But yeah, it's just good, like you say, to have a circle where it's like, yeah, okay, no one is putting you, just because you didn't come as Mrs. or mother of, like, it's such an issue. So things are definitely changing. Okay.
So there's that as well, where people will say, I remember, you know, growing up, or you just hear things like, oh, well, you know, at least have one or two. You want me to have one or two by myself? And again, you know, there is nothing wrong with a woman who does want to have children by herself if she's capable. So there is that stigma as well. You know, you don't have kids, it's a problem, you need to have one or two. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we're just always projecting our thoughts and feelings on others, because it's like, no, it's like, you know, that saying, damn if you do, damn if you don't. It starts from first there's, yo, at least one. And then if it's one is, well, at least it needs to be three. And then even the delivery itself is, okay, was it a C-section? Was it the vagina? Did you breastfeed? Yeah. Did you not breastfeed? Did you? Right. Did you not? Did not? And it doesn't end, you know?
And if you have a lot of children, or that person has too many children, well, what do you want me to do? You know?
Right. So
it's what, like, is it?
Yeah, so it, I don't know, it just doesn't end, but it needs to stop. I don't think things should be that way. So I feel like we always project what we think things should. So when someone says, you know, okay, for me, this is this way, so I'm just going to take this route, we always think, well, that sounds crazy. No, it's not. We're projecting what we're thinking on others.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and we shouldn't. Okay, so we're going to get into, I wanted to find out from you, how many cycles of IVF did you try before you were like, this is enough?
So I tried many cycles of IUI, right?
Okay.
Right. So because the, neither one of us was given a diagnosis of infertility. Mm. So the doctors were pretty adamant about us not going into IVF, you know, let's try IUI first. So I went through several rounds of IUI, and I think I did that for like a year. So you can imagine just being on hormones for like a year, right? Until we went into IVF. With IVF, it was one cycle. The egg retrieval was fairly successful. Well, actually, yeah, one cycle of treatment and then two implantations, you're a nurse. Yeah. Where, yeah, two, you know, where they actually implant the embryo, two cycles of that. So it's one medical cycle of IVF where, you know, they inject you with the hormones, they do the egg retrieval. But because I had quite a number of eggs, I went through two implantations, or I think it's implantations they call it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And what role did writing play in your healing journey?
Oh, it huge. You know, like I said, I struggled for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I like to journal. Mm-hmm. So I journaled through the feelings that I wouldn't express to my husband. The feelings I was having that I wasn't able to express to my mother, who worries a lot, right? Mm-hmm. So it did play a very huge role. It was a way of me actually, how can I say, taking what I was feeling away from me and sort of like handing it over to paper. I don't know if that even makes sense.
No,
but when I wrote it down, I felt like a sense of relief.
Okay. Yeah.
No,
I agree. It's like coloring. You know, when you color, I don't know, if you ever color and you just feel like there's just release and release.
Yeah.
Imagine that journaling, I think, is the same way. It's, you know, it's like you're releasing something to the wall other than keeping it inside.
Yeah. And you know, when you're going through such pain, nobody can really understand. It's very different, like individual to individual. You may find a person who felt, you know, the exact same way and processed things, you know, very similar to how, you know, one another processes it. But I didn't have that. I wasn't fortunate enough to have a person who was feeling the pain that I was feeling and expressing it the way that I was expressing it, right? And partly, again, is because I kind of shut myself up. I really didn't talk about it. I tried therapy once, and it just didn't go right because the therapist referred me back to my family. And, of course, again, my family is going through something similar, right? So it wasn't the right avenue for me. I remember a time when it was so unbearable that I say to myself, not because I wanted to, you know, like kill myself or anything, but I say to myself, it is okay tonight if I leave this realm. Like, it's okay. Because I just couldn't, I couldn't take it. Like, it was, I can't even explain the type of pain. Your mind is occupied, your heart is hurting, you're just in a space where it's unbearable. And then Sometimes you have body aches because I had to have surgery after the first miscarriage. So there was pain associated with that. And most of this, like, really painful process, like physical pain, was, like, you know, right after my first miscarriage. So I say to myself, it's okay. Like, if I leave this realm, I think I'll be fine. But one thing that kind of kept me tethered to, you know, this world is, again, my mom, my family, my husband. And I thought a lot about my mom having, you know, she had lost a child already. And I just didn't want to have her go through that process again, because she still in some way has trauma from losing my older brother. So I had to find strength and just, you know, to keep going. Yeah.
Right. So what do you hope readers, especially, you know, Zambian African women, take away from your story?
So I would hope from the individuals actually experiencing the type of pain that I've gone through, I would say, you know, you're not alone. There are so many, many women going through the, you know, similar challenges. Forgive yourself, because sometimes as women, we tend to think the miscarriage was due to maybe something that is wrong with our body, or maybe something that we ate, or maybe we moved a certain way and induced that, right? So forgive yourself, and because it's not you. And then allow yourself to process the pain the best way you know how. Don't suppress it like I did, because also suppressing pain manifests other symptoms that are not healthy for you. Find a circle of friends if you don't have it already. Or join support groups where you can feel free to express yourself. And cry whenever you feel like crying. Scream if you have to scream in your privacy, in the privacy of your home, right? Mm-hmm. Again, don't blame yourself. Don't blame God, because everything does happen for a reason. That is, you know, something that I would say to a person that's going through or has gone through a miscarriage and still has the residue of that pain. Also, to family members, friends and family members, it's important to allow the person to grieve, to process their emotions. Though the emotions that you feel for that particular individual are valid and they are appreciated, but allow the person to process grief how they can. Like I say, some people choose isolation, like me, in a sense. Sometimes you just want silence, but you do want human presence. And by that, I mean, you want a friend there, but you don't want a friend to talk. So it is a crazy process. You know what I mean? Right. So, you know, don't tell them how, you know, how they should process their emotions. Just be there to listen and support, because they may not be ready to face the reality of things. Encourage when you see an opportunity, and by an opportunity I mean when that individual is ready to talk about what they're going through. So you can offer, you know, suggestions on how or what they should do. It's like I stated, you know, at the lunch that we had this past Saturday, grieving process is not linear. Like, you have so many moments of, like, ups and downs. And sometimes, though you want isolation, you might just want somebody there that you want to just talk, and you want them to, you know, you want them to offer you suggestions on how you move forward. If you recall, I had a friend there, Caroline, who said that she was kind of bummed out a little bit, because she She felt like she wasn't there for me as a friend after reading the book, mm-hmm. but her analytical skills on what is it that could have gone better, those conversations that I had with her were exactly what I needed from her. So give the person grace, give them space to process. I think that's what I would like people who read the book to get from it. There's also the aspect of, you know, men, right? The husbands, the partners that we sort of like disregard when the woman is going through this whole process. Mm-hmm. They're hurting too.
Right.
And knowing how to be there for them is also very important. Because they are human too. They grieve. They also lost a child. So just also being there for the men and to women that that are going through the miscarriage or have gone through it. I know that the process is very painful. It's you. You endure the pain physically. You're going through something emotionally and psychologically. But don't forget that your partner too is going through something. Like your partner has also lost a being that would have been a child, right? So I think having the space, in addition to what I mentioned earlier, to just spend time with your partner to process, to heal, that's very important.
That's really powerful, Angela. And we really thank you for this book. Like I say, this will be a bridge between you and a lot of women, especially from our communities where people don't speak up of this pain. In fact, one of our friends, one of our creator friends in our creator group wrote a beautiful piece about your book. Mm-hmm. And if you want to read it, it's called Pages and Mouths, and mm-hmm. it's by Mark. You can find it on Substack, and it reads, "And in this cruel way, Angela's loss is the world's gain. Her deep understanding of such depths of grief because she has suffered herself will allow her to be an effective mediator between others and their pain. This is the path she has chosen to find meaning and purpose for her experiences." Very, very powerful. And before we pivot, because this is a two-part conversation, we're going to talk about mm-hmm. your Coming to America story. I just want you to share about the children you're helping in Zambia.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. So I am co-founder of a foundation called Titanzizike. And I always have a problem, pronouncing that name, forgive me. But yeah, it's called Titanzizike. I partnered with a reverend back home. His name is Father Mwale, Reverend Mwale. And we, our focus is children in Luangwa, Zambia, who are orphans. And most of them are orphans because Luangwa is a game area. So a lot of, parents, get killed by animals. There are cases where they get killed by crocodiles or stomped by, like an elephant or something like that. And then single mother households as well. So we help those as well whose husbands go off to fishing. And they encounter, they pass, right? Due to circumstances, like I mentioned, maybe was an incident with a wild animal, or maybe they drown or something like that. So right now we had been focused on the entire village before, where it was just feeding and clothing for, about 250 kids, but that became overwhelming for us. What we're doing now is strategizing to cater to children who are most in need. And those are children that have lost both parents. So this year we're not doing any feeding right now. We're focusing on fundraising and just trying to see how best or how much we can fundraise so that we can start an initiative that can then bring in revenue for those children.
Okay. And do you have a page for it, a website, if people wanted to donate or?
Yes. So it's Titandizike Foundation.org. And we had a few glitches with the our payment processing system, which we are working on right now. So if there's an issue with processing, I can give you information later on that you can share with your audience on how to contact Father Mwale himself.
Perfect. We'll add all that information in the show notes. Okay, in the show notes. All right, we are now going to pivot. We want to know how Angela got here. So tell me, what led to your decision to leave Zambia many, many years ago? You know, what were your hopes, fears of the time? Yeah, so how did America come to be?
So it's sort of like a blur, but there wasn't like one particular thing that made me decide to, you know, leave. And again, this is like 25 plus years ago. I think at the time, Zambia had very few opportunities for, you know, young people. I think I struggled with, you know, finding what best worked for me. And I remember, you know, sometimes mom would gather us and she'd be like, well, you know, what do you want to do? What do you want to do? And I always knew, I always had a sense that I would not end up in Zambia. So initially, I had wanted to go to France to study interior decorating. And so my mother was like, well, if you want to go to France, you need to learn how to speak French. So I took French classes at Alliance Française. I think that was in North Mead. Don't ask me to say anything in French because that has been suppressed somewhere in my subconscious. But yeah, so it wasn't one particular thing, but I just knew that I needed to leave, okay, to leave the country. And unfortunately, my plans to go to France did not solidify because of a family member passed away, and that was the person that was really going to that was going to be the person to, you know, kind of like see the whole thing through.
Right.
So when they passed away, you know, there was a sense of, oh my gosh, it's not going to happen. But there was still something kind of burning inside me that was just like, well, you're not going to stay here. Right. And so my mother suggested that I come here. It would be safer for me anyway, because there were a lot of people that she knew. And then an uncle lived in Washington, D.C., and she trusted him with, you know, like my care. If I needed care, I was really coming here solo, but if ever I needed help, I would always reach out to them. Yeah. So there's not really like a, you know, like a particular decision. Well, of course, the decision was not having opportunities back home. So I think that was a driving factor.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So can you describe some of the biggest cultural emotional adjustments you had to make after arriving?
Oh gosh. So cultural adjustments. This is going to be funny, but so when I arrived, I stayed at a hotel called Howard Johnson, downtown DC. And I remember coming out of the hotel and going across the street to like, I think it was like a CVS or some store there that I went to just get like a couple of things for myself. And when I came out, instead of coming out from, you know, the entrance that I used from the hotel, I went through the other, there's like two entrance exit doors, right? So I went through the other exit door, and I got lost. I was literally, like, the hotel was literally around the corner, like less than 2 minutes walk. I got lost and I got a cab.
Wow.
The cab driver was like, do you really want a cab? Because it's right there. I was like, yes, just stop me. Just drop me in front of the hotel, right? But The cultural changes, I think it was the biggest, the biggest thing that I experienced was the food. The food didn't taste the same. The meat didn't taste the same. So that was something. And then I was fortunate enough, you know, after a month or so when I settled in, I ended up in a community, in a very diverse community. So there were a lot of, like, you know, Blacks, Hispanics, white, and naturally I gravitated more to the, you know, to the Black community. Mm-hmm. There were some differences, but there were a lot of commonalities as well, mm-hmm. like the respect factor and, you know, all that, like how you respect your elders. How you address your elders. I remember that. There was a lot of, like, sir, ma'am, similar to va, you know, how we say va such and such, mm-hmm. Back home. The other thing that I think I can remember was my jokes were not palatable to the other people. and neither could I. Yeah, so, well, for me, you know, back home, we do have influence of, like, watching American shows, British shows. So I did have a sense of, like, how things would be.
Right.
But on the ground, of course, it's very different. There was a little bit more profanity in everyday speech than I was used to. Yeah, so that was an adjustment. And just having to be by myself to navigate the world without the guidance of my mom, and to remind myself not to go beyond certain boundaries, because of course I could hear my mom's voice. So I think those are the ones that I can remember. I'm sure you have some that I can relate to.
I mean, oh my God, there were just so many. So obviously culture, like you're saying, first of all, from the food, the way you relate to people, or mm-hmm. it was, like, very different, just like you said, or even the language itself. Like,
yeah.
You know, the language itself was a bit of an issue. Mm-hmm. I think I was depressed that first 6 months, to be honest with
yeah.
you, because, you know, first yeah. of all, I was in Michigan, it was cold, it was snowing. I was like, what the hell did I do? And then just yeah. being able, like, you know, not being able to work so many hours, mm-hmm. or just realizing how broke I'm going to be.
Right.
There was that. Yeah. You know, so it was very hard. And then you have people, you promise people at home, because you're thinking, as soon as I get here, I'll be able to send you $100 at home. And then you realize you cannot. Actually, you cannot. Hey, that Black tax weighs on you. I'm telling
you. I know.
That's a whole conversation for another day. But okay. And so, but I want to know, what are some of the practical challenges, you know, like housing, navigating school and that kind of stuff, and finding your community? How was that? Like, finding your people, where are my people? Like, how was that? And I think you did touch on that. Like, you did gravitate towards Black people. So then did mm-hmm. that then become your community? How did you navigate that, and school as well?
Not quite. You know, you gravitate to a certain group because there are similarities, but not you don't quite fit in, right? Like I said earlier, I did miss my mother. I missed home. So there was that challenge of having to navigate, you know, without her. I didn't see my family for quite a while. But I was fortunate in that, like, I did a lot of research before coming. My mom did a lot of research, but we talked to, like, a lot of people that were here, her friends, and those that had, you know, gone back home. But I do remember, you know, everything just being so overwhelming.
Right.
Everything being very, very overwhelming. Again, like, everything sort of, like, aligned for me, like, in hindsight, right? I'm looking back and thinking everything was aligned. But I think in the moment, there was just a lot of confusion.
Right.
So I, before I came, a friend of mine from back home met a gentleman on her flight back from South Africa. And this gentleman was there to launch his book. I'm not sure if it came. And so she invited me to the book launch. She was like, oh, I met this gentleman, launched his book. And, you know, like, he invited me there. Let's just go for support. And we went there. And I told him that I was coming like in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. And he gave me his business card and he was like, oh, when you come, just, you know, call me. And so I had his information along with other numbers from friends that I, you know, knew from back home. And I initially stayed at Howard Johnson Hotel, like I mentioned, downtown DC. Mm-hmm. My mom had booked that hotel for me, but it was very expensive. Right. And yeah, it was very expensive. And I remember I stayed there for a week and I was looking at how much I had. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like definitely by the end of the month, you know, like all my money will be gone. And fortunately enough, I called that gentleman. He lived very nearby in Washington, D.C. And he was able to assist me with, you know, locating like a smaller hotel closer to George Washington University.
Wait, Angela. So you moved from hotel to hotel again?
I did. I didn't know what to do. Remember, I had numbers for friends that I knew from back home, uh-huh. but none of them was picking up. Yeah, so none of them picked up. I have no idea whether their phones were not working or something. I have no clue. So now I had to navigate from one hotel to another. But this one, this little hotel, it was like a little hotel that was managed by Ethiopians, I remember, and they were so helpful.
Okay.
It was a fraction of the cost. So something that I would pay in a day at Howard Johnson, I paid for a week where I was.
Okay.
Right? Well, maybe 2 days or so. I paid for like a week. And the guy was like, oh, you know, let me know if you need housing. Like, you know, I know you're new here and it's going to get very costly. So I started to, you know, he started helping me out to figure out, well, you know, who does he know who has a room?
Right.
And then I also was like looking through the papers and I came across a number, and I actually just stuck to it because the lady's name was also Angela. And I was like, oh, this is divine alignment here. Mm-hmm. So I reached out to her and she didn't call me back day one, day two. And I mean, I called maybe two or three times. So day three, she calls me back and says, hey, I'm sorry I was away. Please come and, you know, take a look at the room and let me know if you, you know, still want to move. So I went, looked at the room. It was decent, near North Capitol. But of course I was desperate. So
right.
I just went ahead and paid for like 3 months. I was like, I don't care if I have whatever I have to eat. It is what it is. But in these 3 months, I know I would have, you know, gotten a game plan. Something will come up. And she also helped me find my first job at a natural hair care saloon. So for the next 6 months, so I stayed there. So when I moved in, I think it was a week or two. After a week or two, I secured that job at the hair salon. And then I worked at the hair salon for, I want to say, 6 months. It was good money, mm-hmm. but it was a plan that I don't know where it would take me. You know, that sort of thing where, okay, I'm doing hair, I'm making decent money, but I want to go to school.
Right.
I want to do certain things because my whole point was, okay, if my mom's business is kind of like not doing well, you know, there are ups and downs in business and I can help out mm-hmm. when needed. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to do that until much later, but that was the initial plan.
Okay.
Yeah, so I did work. I worked for 6 months. And then, remember the gentleman that I just mentioned who helped me kind of like secure the smaller hotel? He called me up and said, there's something happening at the embassy, and I think you should go because you might actually find somebody that you know from back home. And, you know, you do need social interaction. You need a circle of friends. Yeah. So I listened. I went. And indeed, I found a friend. Like, she was from, we went to the same high school. She was a junior. She never went to St. Mary's. But I am going to mention her name because I don't think she would object. I won't mention her last name, but her name is Ngao. So I met Ngao at the embassy, and she recognized me first, and she was like, "Angela, Angela." I was like, so she, you know, she kind of reintroduced herself, and we got to talking. She asked me a couple of, you know, things like, "Okay, how are you doing? Do you have a job? What's your plan?" So we kind of talked about that, and she had a lot of information that was very helpful. She was a very resourceful person for me. Mm-hmm. So she introduced me to a lady called Rosemary. Rosemary had an agency at the time. It was a very small agency at the time. And she was training nursing assistants and then placing them into, you know, homes and facilities. Mm-hmm. So she trained me, and then later she helped with my CNS certification. And so after I got my CNS certification is when I stopped working for the hair salon. Oh. Right. Yeah.
Well, CNA, that's Certified Nursing Assistant.
Certified Nursing Assistant, yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And did you pursue further education since you really had that desire? And as you're doing CNA, did you pursue further experience? And what was that experience like as an immigrant woman?
Yeah. So I did pursue further education. So the initial plan from CNA was to go into nursing. That's what? I mean, Rosemary was like a surrogate aunt, right? Mm. She'd been here for a while. She'd helped a lot of people. She'd brought a lot of family members from Sierra Leone. I mean, she is a very good woman. And so she wanted me to do nursing, but it didn't quite work out the way No, it didn't work out because naturally I'm not a nurse. Instead, I opted for health services administration. There was like a small school downtown DC that I went to. I got my diploma there. Rosemary later hired me to help her with the billing in her agency. So I did billing for her for a while. And then I also, eventually I did the scheduling, like, you know, where you schedule nurses to go to certain facilities or homes and stuff. So I did billing and scheduling. When I left her agency, I was an office manager, which was a good thing, right? Mm-hmm. But also because I'd done, you know, I had gone to school, I wanted to now sort of like explore the real America. Remember, so I'm coming from Africa, I get into like, okay, this is like a Black community. I'm kind of like fitting in, right? Mm-hmm. But then my work, I am still sort of like in Africa, where, because there was like a lot of like African nurses from the island. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but I just wanted to like explore, like to learn a little bit more, to have this, to grow my portfolio, so to say. So I worked for Rosemary for like 2 years. I later went to work at one of the major hospitals in DC. I got in to the claims processing. It was patient financial services, and my job was to process claims. So while I was there, I decided, this little education that I have is not really going to take me as far as I want to go. So maybe I should go back to nursing. I applied to an LPN school, licensed practical nursing school, and I started. Started to go there. It was very exhausting to juggle both school and work. I later left the organization to just focus on school, which I later dropped out of. When I got to medicine, it was just so traumatic for me. Like, it was so traumatic. Like, the patients, oh my gosh, I couldn't take it. I remember some of my classmates having hives. I know you're a nurse, so did you experience something similar, like where you're going through the disease process and psychologically you feel like, ooh, that could be me?
So for me, I think by the time we were getting to med surge, I was knee deep. But I think it was, I experienced that at the beginning. So you can imagine, I'm in business school thinking about finances, money, and I'm thinking, and I'll never forget, I was on a bus and I saw this lady and she had these like bumps. And I remember just thinking, oh my God, how will I do this?
I know, I know. So one thing that I forgot to share was, so after I got my nursing credentials, my CNA credentials, I signed up with an agency. It was in Silver Spring called Ethio Nurses at the time. And they had jobs, but they had jobs like in Glen Burnie, you know, so far away from everything. And mind you, I'm living in D.C., so I'm commuting from D.C. to Silver Spring. Because the husband to the owner of the agency was sort of like the one who drove us to these facilities in the morning. Technically, you wake up around maybe 3:30, 4 in the morning. By the time you get to Silver Spring, it's like almost 4:35. You wait for him to pick you up, and then you're driving from Silver Spring to like Glen Burnie or these other facilities that are like an hour away. And when we got to those facilities, there was an expectation that you're going to work 16 hours because it's so far. Yes. So again, because I didn't really know the transportation, how transportation works, I really relied on, you know, these people. And so we would, it would be like, it just wasn't me. It would be like maybe 3 or 4 people that would be dropped off at this facility. And we would work 16 hours because this guy also had to go to work. So you can imagine being new to nursing, having to do 16 hours. Oh my gosh, that was something. But also you got to see how even though people suffer, they still have like a smile on their face. Yeah, but it was not something that I wanted to stay in. And that's why I, you know, pivoted over to like health services admin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I forgot where I was.
I was just asking about your further education and you were explaining your journey. So at what point did you go to Ohio for your MBA?
So I went to Villanova before then.
Okay.
And then So after I left the big hospital that I was working at in Claims, right? And then decided eventually that I was not a nurse. I was hired by an agency.
Okay.
And I started working for the company that I'm at right now. And so this is like 20 years ago. I temped there for like 2 years. But while temping, I just decided, you know what? I got to go back to school. I have to learn something. This company is so huge. I mean, it was a medical facility and there were so many other opportunities within the organization that you could actually go into. You know, there's the whole credentialing, contract, there's the nursing space, there's, you know, so there was just a whole lot that you could do and you could grow into. And so I decided to go back to school, went to Villanova. And then after that, I went to Ohio State. I did a master's in business operational excellence. It is similar to an MBA, but it's specializing in efficiency, like operations and efficiency, reducing waste and, you know, improving revenue and all of that. So the experience, right? And I think the second part of your question was, how was my experience in school? In nursing school, it wasn't bad at all because there were so many people from so many parts of Africa. I think that was like a mini African continent. I mean, I had people from Ghana, Ethiopia, Sierra Leone, Nigeria, Zambia, Congo. It was just a lot of people that I, including, you know, some African Americans as well. So that wasn't, it wasn't really hard to navigate. I made friends very easily. The challenge, it wasn't really a challenge, so to say. The difference in dynamics was, I think, when I eventually went to do my master's, right? Now you have a different set of individuals. In my class, it was 33 of us, but there were only 3 Black people. And they were all females. So there was me, there was a lady from Zimbabwe, and then there was an African-American lady. Everybody else was white. But there wasn't, and I think maybe it's just at that level where people are mature, right? I think there wasn't like racism in a sense. We had, you know, we had lunches together, we had outings together. And where I didn't feel welcome, I think I didn't force my presence, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because you know, as an African person, that there might be a little bit of hesitancy in accepting you in, you know, certain circles. Yeah. But I didn't force my presence at all. And I didn't let that bother me. By the end, you know, by the time we were graduating, a lot of us had formed, you know, friendships. And some people are hesitant to know you or may seem a little bit distant because they also don't know how you're going to receive them. Right. So there's that aspect where maybe it's like, you know, I don't know about this person. They don't know about me. And it's just a matter of just that moment of connection.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I know other people experience things differently, but I didn't really have that bad of an experience. The experience that I would say was a little bit questionable was when I worked for that hospital in the claims department, because there were a lot of like people my age. They were mostly coming from, you know, DC, Northeast, Southeast. And I remember them saying that, you know, well, they can't understand what I'm saying. My accent was a problem.
Right.
So I had to learn to kind of twist my tongue again. When you're in France, do as the French do. You can't, you know, you can't object to like a lot of things. It doesn't mean that you are timid or anything. It just means that you kind of want to feel welcome.
Yes, right, right.
Right? Mm-hmm. So you learn to twist your tongue to pronounce certain words, how they can better understand it. And yeah. And then eventually one day you just wake up and it's not a matter of you tricking yourself to twist your tongue. It's really you because you've been here so long.
Yeah.
People you talk to every day. Like I talk to my siblings and they say, oh, well, you have an accent. But when I talk to them, I think I don't have an accent at all. They're like, no, you do. And it's very telling when you go home and the first word you say, somebody knows you are from the diaspora. I'm like, okay, I'm dressed in my little boo-boo. I have my little flip-flops. There's no indication whatsoever that I'm trying to be anything else. That first word.
They can tell. Okay, so before I go to my last question, we're winding down here. There's something you pointed out that you did, I think, was great. You were in a community and you decided to say, wait a minute, let me get out and let me see what others are doing. And I think that's what people should do because you come from Zambia. I'm just giving an example. You come, you find the Zambian community, then you just be doing what everybody else is doing and you won't even know what's out there. So then we tend to all be doing the same thing because, oh yeah, this is the thing. So that's the thing. Because one person heard from the Nigerians that this is what we're supposed to be doing. And then everybody falls in line. Mm-hmm. It is important to hear that, but it's also important to mix with a lot of other people, whether it's Asians, Americans themselves, you know, people born and bred here, you know, Hispanics, all other, and just listen, talk, see what they're doing. You'll be surprised. Mm-hmm. You know
what you can learn,
the different things people are into or what they're doing. I mean, today we have Zambians who are owning businesses and shops and they're hiring people. It might be from other countries, right? Ethiopians and vice versa. So yeah, it's very, so what you did, I think there was great. You thought about that, whereas us were just like, where's the Zambian community? And then so it's like we are isolated. We come here and then you know, again, we are like isolated as a, I mean, and it's good, don't get me wrong, you should find your community. It's good to know because trust and believe, if something happens to you, they're the ones doing it. They're the ones doing that GoFundMe. No one else can do that. It's that your Zambian community, whatever country community, they're the ones who are going to put that GoFundMe for you. So, you know, don't forget that, but mingle with others to get out there and see what others are doing.
Absolutely. It's very important to see what other communities are doing. And I think that America is very unique in the sense that there's there are people from so many parts of the world. There are so many, I mean, it's just a matter of opening yourself up a little bit while maintaining your community, right? You can open yourself up to explore and what other cultures are doing. In order for you to grow as well, you need to kind of like step away from your comfort zone.
Right.
Now that can come with, friends not really understanding you. In a sense that, oh, okay, well, you know, she doesn't really have time for us anymore. But I say, you have a goal, you know what you're coming here for, or you know what you're coming here for. Make sure that you have a roadmap on how you need to achieve that. Getting advice from people is good, but also filter the advice and make it be suitable for your journey. Because right. What works for you is not what works for me, but your success is my success, because then I can, you know, get to learn a little bit more or just be out there a little bit more. Look at what we're doing now. You and I met like what, 20 years ago?
Right.
But look at us now. And there's a moment that, you know, you had gone off to do your thing. I was doing my thing. Mm-hmm. We hadn't really communicated in like a long time. But when we got together, it was almost like we didn't lose those years.
Right.
And so, yeah, don't put yourself in a box where you cut off everyone. Keep the people that you think are really good for your progress, because some people will try to pull you down, mm-hmm. but keep the circles that you know nurture your ambitions in a sense,
right,
and
right.
people that will actually guide you, because sometimes your ambitions may be too far-fetched and somebody will say, okay, hold up, maybe do this before you go there.
Right.
Like I have a very dynamic sort of like circle of friends. I have friends whom in Zambia, they would be like my aunties, mm-hmm. right? But they are my friends, and I know I go to them for guidance.
Right.
And they are friends that are much younger than me that I know can rejuvenate, you know, a piece of me that is like tired.
Right.
I can look at them and say, dang, when I was your age, I was like doing this and this and that. And yeah, so, you know, do what you can. Make sure that you try your best to be a part of the American community. Mm-hmm. Serve the people that, you know, are around you. One thing that I forgot to mention is, you know, during my first 3 years, I became a president of an association in Washington, D.C. for low-income housing. And the association managed to get, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars from the DC government in order to secure homes for 26 families. So these are the types of things, again, if you're going through the immigration process, you have to prove that you are trying to be part of the community. There are things that you're doing, join associations, do things in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be afraid that, you know, oh, maybe if I do this, it's too much. I'm exposing myself. Do things within your limit. Make sure you get the right people to guide you through, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, a good circle of trusted friends where you feel safe to express yourself is very important.
Absolutely. So looking back, what do you wish you had known about America before coming here?
Oh, gosh. that racism is almost a daily conversation,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think a lot of some of the guests that I've presented on your show have said the same thing or something similar. Back home, you're not reminded that you're Black. But here, you're reminded you're Black. And I think almost like this is like a systematic problem that does suppress people in a sense, because sometimes you veer off from actualizing your full potential. from growth and from just having a sense of belonging. There is that term that you know, they coined up most recently. What is it? The imposter syndrome.
What?
You know where you go, the imposter syndrome?
Oh, imposter syndrome, yes.
Yes. So when you go into a room and then you feel like you don't quite belong there, mm-hmm. right? Oh, you go into a meeting and maybe you're the only Black person. That's like, you know, one of the first things that you probably realize, like, oh, I'm the only Black person here. Mm-hmm. Whereas in other, you know, places, I'm assuming in Zambia, you're not going to go into like a meeting and think, oh, we're all Black here. But I think that the color thing is like something that I didn't really
think about.
So yeah. And then the other piece is, you know, I had done a fair amount of research. And like I mentioned, you know, mom had talked to like a number of her friends. So a lot of things weren't too much of a shocker. Like, say, for instance, they tell you, you need a social security number, you need this, you need that in order for you to get a job. But it's now when you're on the ground that you're like, okay, well, how do I do that? I know I need this, but how do I do that? Who do I talk to? Where do I go? And then now you have to learn, like, okay, with this social security number, at the end of the year, you're going to have to file your taxes, right? Like, there were a lot of surprise, even though you may do as much research as you want, but there are surprises along the way, because there are some things that you may not know, that you may know, but then you don't know what the next step to that is. Only when you arrive here do you learn those things. And it's very important when you relocate to also learn about the immigration system. I think that's very important, regardless of what status you are, whether you come here as a visitor, whether you come here as a student or as a fiance or whatever it may be. Learn the immigration system, learn the rights that you have, you know, what you can and cannot do within your, you know, within that framework that you're given. I think it's very important. Often we come here and we want to shy away from, you know, learning about the immigration process because we think we want to make money and we're going to do it undercover. But I think at the end of the day, knowing the immigration system is very pivotal to your success in living here.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think there are a few, I'm going to add them in the show notes because I can't think of it right now. I know it was a couple mm-hmm. of independence parties that I went to, maybe like a couple years ago. There was a lady, mm-hmm. I think her name is Helga. She's from Zimbabwe. Her and the people actually started an organization where as you come, you join to sort of some of these resources. And I think it's based in Bethesda, Rockville or Bethesda. Okay. And just to know, like, where are the immigration lawyers, where are the doctors mm-hmm. you can see about insurance? Because mm-hmm. some of the things you don't think about signing up for insurance. And even when you sign up for insurance, you're signing up for the cheapest because you're trying to save money because you want to send some of that money home.
Oh, and, my God. It just reminded me of something.
And you're setting yourself up, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So when I think that was the first year that I was here, I got sick and I ended up in the emergency room. I had no clue how much an ambulance would cost. I had no clue. I ended up in debt, okay? And that debt was on my credit score for a long time. So, yeah, definitely learning about the healthcare system, the insurance, and all of that is also very important.
All right. So some fun questions. Angela, you're from Zambia, just like me. Your Tonga, just like me, even though your Tonga does sound different, but I do understand. You know, because they said there's Tonga from, it's from the valley. It's Tonga from the valley. It's Tonga from, I don't know, the plateau. It's Tonga from, I don't know where, Gwembe. There's one there.
Yeah.
And someone tried to say, no, maybe it's Ill. I'm like, no, that's a whole different, okay?
Just a mixture of whatever.
But when people ask you where is Zambia, what do you say?
I say Southern Africa.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So if somebody tells you they want to go to Zambia next week, where are you telling them to go? What should they visit? What should they see?
I think
it can't be the Victoria Falls.
No. I think first they should visit Lusaka. Okay. Lusaka has a lot of different, you know, places that you can go to. whether you want to, you're about the nightlife or lounges, or maybe you just want to go to like a local market and see how that works. There are a lot of things that go on in Lusaka that I think maybe I'm a little bit biased because I'm, you know, from Lusaka. I grew up in Lusaka. I think Lusaka does give you a sense of the fun part of Zambia, but also does showcase some of the struggles, because you have like, you know, you have the really rich places, and then you have like the, you know, the places where people have challenges in life, right? Mm-hmm. So if you do want to visit Zambia, visit Lusaka first. I know Victoria Falls is, I'm all about Victoria Falls. I'm all about Zambian tourism. But I think Zambia will give you a flavor of the rest of the country, and then you can explore. Okay. Where would you tell the person to go?
So obvious. Okay, I'm not going to say Southern Province. I've never been to Sanfia Beach, and I've been wanting to go there. And if you listen to my last couple of episodes, I probably mentioned this. I've never been there, so I'd probably say visit in Sanfia Beach. I would like to go there. And for maybe a national park, obviously, because everybody goes to Livingstone, like we said, and lately maybe Lower Zambezi, I would say try one of those lodges in maybe something like Luangwa National Park or something like that.
Well, that's close to Lusaka, right? So yeah, there's Chaminuka, there are other like little game places that you can go visit. Yeah, those are local. That's true. Yeah.
What is like Luangwa? I'm trying to think, because we went there when I was in grade six. We used every sixth grade. Mm-hmm. I used to, if you went to the trust school, if you went through the trust school system, every time you mm-hmm. go to grade six, you were taken to the national park, and we went to mm-hmm. Afuala National Park. It was, I think you're coming from the Copper Belt as though you're going to Lusaka, but I think somewhere mm-hmm. Mumbwa. I want to say it was like Mumbwa. There's a mm-hmm. turn you make to go to the national park before mm-hmm. Mumbwa, and yeah, you get into Luangwa National Park, and yeah, they're different. Inside there, they have like Ngoma Lodge, Kafuala, and they have so many beautiful
right.
places that you can go to. So yeah, I'd probably recommend something like that. But I will say, yeah, visit, you know, you can go to the Copper Belt. I'm biased too, right? Because I'm from the Copper Belt.
Oh.
Because I mean, people do have that. Like, let's say if you want, I know in Chingola, if you go, you can go to Mokoro Game Ranch. You can go and, you know, see like peacocks, animals, rabbits, whatever. You know, people have that kind of stuff. So yeah, you know, it happens on the Copper Belt too.
And, you know, I say, and I say, you know, go to Lusaka, because a lot of Westerners or people outside of the African continent see Africa only wildlife, you know, the village people and stuff like that. So it's also good to see that aside from all of that, there's much more to Africa. And the city lives also has, you know, so many, so much entertainment that you can actually enjoy, and then you can get to meet the Zambian people. Not that, you know, if you go to the village, of course, I'm not saying don't go to the village, don't get me wrong. It's just that that is the picture that these people have. So I say go to the city as well, and then you can go into, you know, the national parks and all these other stuff. If you want to land in the Copper Belt, do so. But I think it's very important that people also see the real lives. Like, this is how we live here. And this is not just what you see on TV. And this is not what you're not, yes, this is not what you're going to take back. Or a rhino. Yes, there are rhinos there. Yeah, there are people, you know, that live in the village. By the way, I would love to own like a little house in the village just to have like, you know, a peace of mind, serene, whatever. But that's not all Africa is about. There's so much more. And I think that people need to start exploring the much more and not be stuck on what they see on TV.
I agree. And I think over time it has changed because of social media. So people, I think people now understand. And you know, now we have games that you can watch from here on Peacock, right? For example, we had, what was it? the Africa Cup of Nations last year, which was in Senegal, right? And you could watch it from here. So, I mean, and you could just see, you're like, wow, beautiful people driving through Senegal. And you're like, wow, it's this beautiful, the infrastructure, the buildings. So people are getting to know. And to your point, even Zambia, you're right. But on the Copper Belt, you know, because Copper Belt was very developed, actually. So, you know, you can find all the towns, rich people, big houses, swimming pool, that kind of stuff. You can find that on the Copper Belt as well, because the structure was very, the way it was made, by ZCCM, it had a certain structure. Every town had like sports facilities, swimming pool, which is where we learned how to swim. Those of us who grew up on the Copper Belt, if you ask most of us, you know, we can swim, you know, because a lot of people don't know this. Even like Zambians, they get surprised, like, oh, yeah, you guys live that life on the Copper Belt. I'm like, yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, we live that life on the Copper Belt. You know, actually, there's even direct flights to Ndola, you know, if you go.
Right. And I think that there was a very good mining hospital back in the 70s where that was better than UTH, University Teaching Hospital.
Equipped, you know, staffed, equipped, even the training for nursing, I think it was called Ronald Ross.
Absolutely.
I think it was in Mufulira, Oh my, in the days of ZCCM, man, you couldn't touch the Copper Belt.
Yeah, Zambia is a beautiful place and it's worth exploring. I would like to have time, God willing, to, you know, travel around, go to the southern province, explore a lot, or, you know, to the western province. I have never been to the Kuomboka ceremony. That is something that I would love. Yeah. That is something that I would love to do.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. But yes, in between, you know, there's a lot of struggle too. But it's just like here, where we don't imagine that you can find a homeless person here. You know, you come here, you just see like the way it looks in Hollywood, on the movies, and then you come here and they're homeless people, they're poor people. You don't expect that. It's the same thing for us. They're people living lives, having beautiful lives, you know, activities, doing all kinds of stuff. Yeah, then, but the struggle is there too. That's not a lie. We do have poor people, a lot of people struggling. And, you know, with the lack of social services that work like they do here, there's a gap, which where I think some of us should fall in that gap, you know, and try and do what you're doing with your foundation, try and help the people in need, because there are a lot of people that need us. All right, Angela. So tell me, what was the last book, movie, or podcast that you listened to from Zambia?
Not from Zambia. You know, I'm like, I listened to your podcast. The last segment I listened to was, of course, the one that you had with Rohini.
Okay, Ruben, yeah.
I thought that was very informative. It was very interesting. I have not read any book from Zambia. Show I would say is, I just watched The Red Bag for the 19th time.
What is it called?
The Red Bag.
Oh, it's from Zambia?
Yeah, it's a movie. I think it's called The Red Bag or Red Bag. Yeah, it's a comedy. You can find it on YouTube. It's kind of old, but it's very funny. Yeah.
Well, I need to write that down. The Red Bag.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. And of course, you know, there's the Shimumbi that I watch. I'm always asking mom about Mpali because I kind of like that. So, I think, you know, last movie would be The Red Bag. Even though it's old, people don't laugh. That's all I have.
You know that Shimumbi was here at the last Independence Party, the 16th.
I know. Yeah, I saw the picture. Yeah, and I saw the promotions on the Eddie. Is it AZDMV forum?
Yes.
I'm having interest again in reading. I used to read a lot, but, you know, over time, work, life gets in the way. But yeah, so being in touch with you definitely makes me want to read more books. But you share some of the ones that you read. We'll talk about them offline, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, sure. And yeah. We will. So what's your favorite Zambian meal?
My favorite Zambian meal is Nsima with vinkuvala. But these vinkuvalas, only mom can make them the way I want them. The way I like. I love them. I've tried to make them. I've had them in other, you know, in other places or, you know, parties where I'm invited, but they're not quite like my mother's. So yeah, Vinkovala, I love kapenta, even though I never used to eat it when I was back home, but I love it. Mm. I also love, what is the Zambian polony again?
Chikanda.
Chikanda, yes. I also love it very much. I got those packaged, pre-packaged one, but it just never came out the same.
I think it's edge.
Really?
You know, someone shared in our AZDM group, they said they asked, mm-hmm. has anybody cooked with this? Because I followed the instructions to a T,
yeah.
and it didn't come out right. And then somebody said, no, you have to add your own extra chikanda or something. So I think, so now I'm scared to open mine. I'm like, I don't want to butcher it.
Yeah, it came out horrible. It came out horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I also like, there's a tiny little fish, Daluva. Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
It's like a stinky fish, but it's so tasty. Yeah. I know it in Tonga, but I don't know. Maybe that's it.
There's a mulonge name in Tesa, but I don't know. What is it called? Oh, you're trying to think of the Tonga name.
I was trying to think of the Tonga name. That's the only name that I know. But anyway. But yeah, I do like, yeah, those are my favorite. I have Vinkovala in my, you know, pantry. I have kapenta. I do have dried vegetables, but I don't quite cook them, you know, the way that I like them. But yeah, so any Zambian dish is good, vimbombo. But those two, kapenta and Vinkovala with sima, you've got me.
Oh,
I remember the little fish. It's called tutaka.
Tutaka. You know
tutaka? Yes.
Tutaka. Tutaka. My dad used to get them almost all the time. Because, you know, you could get them on the market in the streets when you're coming. Oh, my God.
They are so tasty.
And you know, you can find them in the Asian market, something similar.
No way.
They have something similar to tutaka. In fact, when I get them, that's what it reminds me of. It reminds me of my dad. It's like a warm feeling.
Oh,
you know, my dad. Yeah. You fry them.
Love.
So,
when you fry them, make sure you have the net because you will attract a little bit of, you know, unwanted insects.
Yes.
But they taste so freaking good.
I don't even know what they're called. Like, I guess, I don't even know what they were called, like, in English. Because the fresh kapenta was the smaller ones, right?
The smaller ones, which I think they might call anchovies as well. Yeah. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Very interesting. All right, Angela, this has been fun. We have come to the end of this. But before we say our goodbye, do you have any final thoughts, anything we might have forgotten to mention?
Just, you know, thank you for the opportunity, you know, to talk about the book and of course revisit old memories. This was very refreshing. Yeah, so I'm very grateful for that. And then for those that, you know, need a copy of the book, you can find it on Amazon. Be sure to leave a review so that, you know, a lot more people can have access to much needed information. I think it's wonderful when people can relate to an experience and know that they're not alone. So definitely. Thank you again.
That is wonderful. Are there any social media platform handles you'd like to share?
On Instagram, and I recently changed my handle. I hope I can, I hope I remember. I think it's Angela Nedekovic. Angela _ Nedekovic _ author.
Okay. Well, you will send it to me so I can just put it in the show notes as well for people to read and see. You know,
I sure will.
So we can put it down there. This has been a pleasure. I thank you so much for your time. And to everybody, don't forget to rate and review, share, like, and subscribe, and listen to wherever
you listen.
Your podcast.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to
get my girl out there. Thank you so much, Zenith. Okay.